Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer turning other colors, because he's already a man of color, Williams.
That's on the edge of something that I don't know if you want to be there. Hello, everybody.
We're also joined by part-timer, stenographer, intern, Horbius Capus, whatever their legal term is, Amy. And friend of the show, Amy.
Horbius Capus?
Habeas corpus, isn't it?
There you go.
Habeas that's corpus.
A
thing.
Yeah, that's a legal term.
Okay, wonderful.
Horbius Capus.
Well, Amy's here. She didn't bring coffee, but we're having her on the
show. And it didn't
she brought snacks this
I
time.
I haven't had one. So
you
it's okay.
Didn't
whatever.
Ask.
No, we have a great show in store. Speaking of mood swings, we got a great show in store as we are talking about the recently Pixar dropped film, Turning Red. So stick around as we dive into that and we get into all the little nuances of that wonderful film. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you give them opening credits?
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We got over 300 episodes over there. Everything from, are you really opening something in the middle of the show? Are you for real? That's worse than opening a can. You're like, seriously. Oh my God. Check out our episodes over on the Filmlosophers website. Everything from romance to action to anime to comedy. Everything that you're looking for, we have over on our website, filmlosophers.com. Also, check out all of our great episodes over on any streaming platform for podcasts. Everything from Google Play, Libsyn, iTunes, Audio Boom, Pandora, Spotify, TuneIn. You can tune in to all of our episodes on any of those platforms. Give us a like, give us a follow, subscribe, give us a 5-star review. I believe we deserved it. And just check us out all over there. Also on the socials, you can check us out there as well. But we're excited because we're going to be talking about a new dropped film. Oh my God. Are you for real? Are you serious? We literally can't even
do this before.
You can even Spencer saying, couldn't you do this before? You're over here breaking candies, opening boxes.
You do have to break them before.
Are you done?
I am.
Are you sure you're
I am.
Done?
I am.
You're not gonna break it beforehand. You
no,
have to take
thought,
it a bite out of
like,
the whole thing.
I thought it was
you're
wasn't
on a microphone
snap.
And the microphone is attached to the table and you're
I
using the table
think it
to
was
break
going
your
to snap
chocolate
so
bar.
Much. Can I
see?
Yeah.
See, yeah,
it
that's
was,
gonna.
It
snap.
Was a lie.
That's
yeah.
A
see,
you
so
could have
was,
just taken it off of the table and used your hands. No. But no.
I no.
Okay, so we're excited. Well, we were excited. We're still excited, somewhat, but lesser because Amy's over here making noise.
Are we still recording? I thought we stopped.
No, everything's going.
I thought he stopped too. That's why
no,
I was getting.
The show is going. This is all going on the show. This is all
I'm,
going in the episode.
I'm
drop.
In trouble.
Yeah. We're excited to talk about this upcoming or this film that just recently dropped on Disney Plus as an exclusive, and we'll talk about all of that and more when we get into the room. But before we do, we haven't had Amy come on in a bit and talk about a particular movie that she hasn't seen that she has just recently seen. And so in another awesome segment of Jane on Scene, Amy, tell us what you saw.
Not without me breaking things and disrupting people.
Right.
I got to see Sorry to Bother You, which I had heard around the way. Of course, Spencer said, man, you see it, it's crazy.
It's a crazy movie.
Then Boots Riley? I almost said Boots. Boots Riley.
Boots Riley directed it.
He's really great. So, quick premise of this. There's a gentleman by the name of Cassius Green.
Played by?
The guy, one of the guys from Get Out that I remember.
Played by Lakeith Stanfield.
I like him.
Okay.
And he's dating Emma Thompson. Tessa Tompa.
Tessa Tompa.
Tessa Tompa.
Tessa Tompa.
Tessa Tompa. Tessa
Tompa. See, this is what happens when you decide to distract everybody from the show, and instead of you breaking candy and opening packages
and imbibing,
you could have just, you know, all your habeas corpus. You could have been doing
capus.
Habeas capus. You could have been doing that before you did all that.
Tessa Thompson.
Do you remember the name of her character?
Detroit.
Oh my God.
Her name was Detroit, and she's a visual artist. So Cassius Green is, who goes by the name Cash, he is looking for a job. His friend recommends he works at this place called, Regal View telemarketing company. He's going to work down in the basement. He gets to, on happenstance, sits next to one day Donald Glover, who tells him, you know, the reason you're not making sales is because you're not using your white voice, man. And he's like, he plugs his nose and is like, sorry to bother you, Mr. Marvel. And I was like,
Amy,
okay,
you're white. You can just use your regular voice.
That's really mean. And I don't have the white voice where it sounds like all your bills are paid and there's nothing to, he makes this entire case about how it's a sound. But suddenly, Cash channels into it. He gets really good at it. And he ends up being promoted to being a power caller, which is like some fictitious VIP shenanigans thing you don't think is real. Come to find out, it's real. And I said Donald Glover, not Danny Glover, right?
It's Danny Glover.
Darn it, it's Danny Glover. I was like, angels in the outfield. Danny Glover gives him the heads up and just reminds him the difference between the two, the power callers and what they are, it's apples to Holocaust. And that's the difference of what they're selling. Yeah, it's not apples to oranges, it's apples to Holocaust. Anyway, Cash gets in it for the money. He's getting good at it. He starts making money. Meanwhile, out in society, there's something called worry-free, i.e. it's indentured slavitude, people. It's not even servitude, it's slavitude. Yeah. I'm going with that. You sign up, you have a Jeffrey Bezos type of person. Cash ends up getting in with him, and he comes to find out that there's, I'm not going to spoil it.
So don't spoil it. Okay, so that's good enough.
That's capitalism is evil.
Okay, so
with the man.
So we get it. You're going to do a whole play-by-play of the film. So let's not do that. So what were your thoughts on the film, and what did you get out of it? And
well, there's a lot to talk about it. It is crazy. The ending, you do not expect it to be the ending that it is.
That's actually the best part.
Right?
Because this movie, like, even like the trailers for the movie that you can see on YouTube, like, they set up, like, oh, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, the anti-capitalism, like, oh,
yeah.
Like, people of color have to, like, pretend to be white to, like, sell things. And then it just shifts.
Yeah.
So hard. No kidding. So fast. It's
and
so great.
I'm giving the hardest stare at Spencer because Spencer's like, hey, have you seen this movie? We should see it. I'm like, oh, okay. He goes, here, let me show you a trailer. I see the trailer. I'm like, I'd seen it before, but I was watching it. I'm like, yeah, let's watch it. He doesn't give me any warning.
None.
Good
he didn't
man.
Tell me anything.
He didn't give me a warning when I told him I was going to watch it. And he goes, oh, yeah. And then when you did it, too, you're like, yeah, it's going to be good.
Just
go for it.
I'm just carrying along the tradition here.
Yeah, this really is the legacy of this movie, is no warnings to any friends who might be watching
it. It's
great that way, though. Yeah. I don't think if I knew what was going to happen, I would be like, oh, okay, I can watch it.
Because I'm like halfway through. I'm like, yeah, like totally, man. Yeah, I can get the social commentary. What the heck is that? And I'm literally looking at Armie Hammer and saying, that's why you're in trouble, man. That's why you're not doing Hollywood anymore. Because the first time you showed it to me and you were watching me, and I was like, why is he watching me right now? And then the scene happens and you're like, what is this? What is this?
More than one scene.
Like, no.
But you're invested. You can't let go.
Yeah.
And it's not even just as a train wreck. You're like, I need to know what happens. Which is a complete compliment to Boots, because straight across the board, I am... Why are you laughing?
I'm just... The way you said that, it was just a complete compliment to Boots. You know what I mean? like him and Dora do so well.
I didn't even say that. But it's a compliment to him because of not only the way that the story is lined up, but how we feel about our protagonist and moving forward. And it's kind of this... It's not even you're so invested you don't want to look away. And it turns out to be such a spectacular, aside from the commentaries, the acting is great, it doesn't seem to age, which is kind of scary to think about, that it didn't age.
It's only 4 years old. Maybe if at that. Do you know, since you're reviewing this movie, Amy,
nope.
What?
My phone's dead, so you can't get any more information out of me. Ha ha ha. No, I don't even remember when it was, when it came out. But yeah, I totally recommend this.
2018.
Okay, so it's 4 years old.
Give or take, yeah.
Yeah, five.
January 2018, so.
But so, I recommend this. Spencer, thank you for this recommendation. Oh, yeah, and for totally, like, not letting me know. I loved, like, the color. There was moments of, like, high fantasy and fantastical moments. Like, it hit things for me where I was like, oh, I like this. And then I'm like, what's going on? And I'm like, no, I didn't see that coming. And I was like, I expected you to be with that person, and you did. And so, stuff like that.
Yeah, this is one of those types of movies that changes the name of the game when you have social commentary films. Mm. It now blends this unique fusion, if you will, of social commentary for the African-American plight in current day with sci-fi like parallelism to create this story that doesn't truly make sense unless, number one, you are a person of color or a person who has faced discrimination, or mm-hmm. two, you are open-minded enough to see beyond the constructs of just what it is as what it is. Because this movie is not just what it is as
100%.
It is.
Nope, it is not.
You know, because if that was the case, this is a pretty messed up movie. but putting it blindly, like, this movie completely changes the way we now see social commentary and the capability, if you will, of filmmakers to create social commentary films outside of just like, oh, well, this is the story of this person who plays the, you know, the color person or the person who's, you know, discriminated against, and this journey that he has, that's kind of, you know, figurative of what they're going through. It now is like, yeah, you can use other things now in terms of at their disposal for filmmaking to create social commentary pieces, even to the most outlandish ways of what Boots Riley does. And I think, honestly, I think that gives way for a lot of what Jordan Peele now does and gives him kind of that boost to do those types of things that we've seen him do. Like what we saw with Get Out, or we saw with
Us,
or now with upcoming movie. Nope.
I'm excited. I don't know what it. I don't know what's coming down the pipe, and I'm still excited, and I'm scared.
Because Steven Yeun, who got famous because of The Walking Dead, he's coming a few films, but he's in this movie, and he's also going to be in Nope.
Yeah,
which is going to be really cool. So it's really interesting. I wouldn't be surprised if Lakeith Stanfield, who did a role in
Get Out,
comes to play a role in Nope as well. It's just there's a lot of awesome opportunities for representation and actors of color that Jordan Peele really does latch onto to continue using them so that they get that kind of opportunity there.
Yes.
But yeah, okay. So
I liked it.
I saw it.
I hadn't seen it before. I liked it. I approve. I will not spoil the ending. It is an ending that you need to experience firsthand for yourself. So please, if you have the time, check out Sorry to Bother You. Of course, directed by Boots Riley.
I'd also recommend that the ending would make no sense.
100%. If you,
because you can say it right now, and it's like nonsense.
Well, and then that's a bigger turnoff. Like being able to watch this, sit down, and kind of go, okay, I kind of get the premise, and you're going through it, and you're like, man, I understand that. And then you get to the end, you're like, nope, don't understand that.
There you go.
Okay.
Well, that transitions us over into our main part of the show, and that is our conversation and review of Pixar and Disney Animation Studios Turning Red. This is a film that honestly has created a lot of buzz. It's created a lot of conversation. There's a lot of people who have been making more and more statements about it. It's actually divided a lot of the fandom who love Pixar films or love animated movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's created a lot of like buzz in terms of divided sides, people who see it for it, the great things that it does, and people who see it for, you know, what it is doing inappropriately. So before we dive into that, Spencer, why don't you jump in and let us know through these wonderful angelic voices the official synopsis goodness.
Mei Li is a confident, dorky 13-year-old torn between staying her mother's dutiful daughter and the chaos of adolescence. Her protective, if not slightly overbearing, mother, Ming, is never far from her daughter, an unfortunate reality for the teenager. And as if changes to her interests, relationship, and body weren't enough, whenever she gets too excited, which is practically always, she poofs into a giant red panda.
That's right, Spencer on the ones and twos. Directed by Dami Shi in her feature directorial debut from a screenplay written by herself and Julia Cho, the film stars the voices of Rosalie Chiang, Sandra Oh, Ava Morse, Maitreyi Ramakrishnan, Hyun Park, Orion Lee, Wai Ching Ho, Tristan Alaric Chen, and James Hong.
James Hong!
A couple pieces about the film. The movie was intended to be released in theaters in 2022, but, yeah, as with Soul and Luca, it jumped from a planned theatrical release to an exclusive debut on Disney Plus due to the rapidly increasing spread of the COVID-19 Omicron variant.
Uh-huh.
Pixar's staff obviously were once again dissatisfied with their next big feature being stuffed onto the platform without a theatrical release.
Which I also find kind of odd at this point. Mm-hmm. Because, like, this was not the story for Encanto, like, back few minutes ago. Yeah. And I'm like, why do you think Pixar movies are like the discount Disney movies? Because
and I think we had a conversation about this a couple episodes ago, but I feel that
We had it when we were talking about Luca, to be plain and simple, because I believe even the title of the episode was something about the execs. I'll fight it. Go ahead.
But basically that Disney has kind of been like, Pixar has always been Disney's rival for Disney animation ever since they hit the ground. And now that Pixar is owned by Disney, Disney goes, I don't want to have you have any opportunities to get additional awards. They're trying to force them back into the box so that they can, so Disney Animation can come out and say that they are the forefront of animation once again. Problem is, instead of accepting them and going, yeah, Pixar is a part of us, we're part of Pixar, we're a team, they are legitimately like trying to hide them in the cupboard, in the kitchen somewhere.
Well, that's like, that's the thing about Encanto, because like, while I was watching this, I'm like, this movie, to me, like, it's great in its own, like, aspects, but it also feels like it's trying very hard to be a Pixar movie, and it's not.
Yep.
And it's so weird to me that, like, there is this very strong rivalry between two entities in the same company.
In the same company.
And I don't understand what the heck is going on.
Because it also goes to, like, right now. So that episode, by the way, is Lesson 273, Luca Silencio Execs. That's what we had titled it, because it was under that mindset of, like, you know, they were wanting to keep pushing the Pixar films to we talked about it. If you want to check it out, check out the conversation, Lesson 273. But I feel like this consistent push for every Pixar film to keep coming out like this really does speak volumes to whatever it is that Disney is trying to do to minimize the impact of Pixar. Because right now, if we look at it, prior to all this, back in like the 2000s and everything, when Pixar was procured, Pixar movies were the biggest push. Like, they were constantly talked about.
Always, yeah.
And what did Ames? I think we had talked about it at one point in time. There's an era for Disney during that season between, like, what is it, 2000?
Yeah, before their second renaissance, where they hit it. So that entire 2000s era, right after the renaissance, which is where we saw Little Mermaid, that entire section, I think they called it the second dark age, but it was Pixar, was primarily Pixar and DreamWorks, and I almost said Blue Sky, but DreamWorks Animation was in that section, and they were the ones that were consistently putting out great stuff. There was less of a drive for animation from Disney Studios proper. And then when we hit Princess and the Frog, where they had reacquired John Lasseter, which is towards the tail end of that was where they came back in for Disney Animation and started back up.
So there was 11 movies during that second dark age that Amy's talking about. It was Chicken Little. Chicken Little.
Which you
Home
like
on the Range. Are you done over there?
No, never.
Okay. Chicken Little, Home on the Range, Dinosaur, ugh, Atlantis, The Lost Empire,
good,
Bolt, Treasure Planet,
yes,
Fantasia 2000,
okay,
Meet the Robinsons,
yes,
Lilo and Stitch,
yes,
Brother Bear, and The Emperor's New Groove.
Eh.
Now, Out of all those, I think the most recent one probably has to be
Emperor's New Groove.
Yeah, it's really difficult to see
because Emperor's. So even in that run up,
it wouldn't have been Meet the Robinsons.
Mm, what was that? 07?
I'm checking right now.
It should have been before 07.
Yeah, it's 07.
Yeah, so then it might have been them.
Yeah.
So, but like, so you had this time frame where when Disney procured Pixar, their focus was to build up Pixar. And to create all these things where they were pushing Pixar movies because it didn't seem like they were putting a lot of effort on the Disney side.
They didn't, at that time, they didn't have an animation studio anymore. It's the same thing that kind of happened initially where Don Bluth.
Well, they obviously did because they made 11 movies.
They had it, but they weren't churning out mega hits every single time, which was their biggest goal.
No, but what I'm saying is there was still a studio, probably not aptly named Disney Animation Studios, but there was still a studio for Disney that was putting out, because it's called the Walt Disney Studios.
Yes.
You know? And so at the time, my thought is, at the time, there was this big push to try to get everybody, you know, all these movies out and whatnot, and for Pixar to really bring in the money and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I feel like it wasn't until Marvel came in and was procured by Disney that Disney was like, okay, switch. Let's kind of put more of our focus on them getting all this attention, putting Pixar on the back burner. The problem is they didn't really consider Pixar still to push good movies out. And all of a sudden with the pandemic and everything kind of came like a really good opportunity for them to kind of put them on that back burner to not be as so widely known. Because, I mean, we're still getting, what, four or five Marvel films
every year
so far, just about.
But it takes 3 to 4 years or more to make these Pixar films. So when they're coming out, and they're coming out back to back to back to back to back, you have to think about that the animators and the teams at Pixar that are aggressively working on this are on it nonstop. And the thing is that I've always felt that the company, the House of Mouse, should honor and respect the hard work that these guys have done. And give them a theatrical run. Even if they do an Encanto and they take it on the back end and they throw it in there for however, and then like, and we're doing a limited theater run release, because then if it's released on a streaming platform, are they eligible for any awards?
Yeah, they so because of COVID, during 2020, they actually opened up those platforms to streaming movies now. Which is why Roma won Best Picture that year.
But is that a temporary measure, or is that
it hasn't changed.
So at this time, they might be up for stuff, but then they're also now running up against...
But what it limits most, more than anything else, which is when you have a exclusive drop or things like that to a theatrical release, number one, you're limiting it to people who have a Disney Plus account.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, you're limiting the amount of revenue that film can build so that on that revenue, they can create an Oscar campaign, because it's out of that revenue as well as a marketing budget set aside for the film that they're able to push for Oscar awards or award season. So, and there's a lot of, you know, conversation, especially when you have a movie that is very relevant and talked about and still on everybody's tongue. In theaters, it makes it easier to keep those people who are behind that film relevant in talks with like Hollywood execs and people who are looking to, you know, build on something such as like this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, and it looks like something that honestly they're going to have to. I said it before during the Luca episode. I really do feel like there's going to come a point where Pixar can possibly, you know, band together or unionize or do something to where they can get bought out, because they're essentially another company just under them, under Disney.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what the possibilities are. I don't even know like what their options are at this point, but I'm pretty sure a lot of them are really kind of considering. Well, they're disheartened, but they're also, I feel like the people that are in power at Pixar are trying to find opportunities to get themselves more seen as an independent equal, because they are pretty much when it comes to films.
Oh yeah,
Pixar blows Disney Animation out of the way. So who knows? I mean, there's really big hope. And then with everything going on with this, you know, this bill that Disney apparently supported, but down in Florida, and it's mm-hmm. it's gaining popularity with a lot of people in terms of how Disney needs to be checked and put into held accountable. I don't know. We could be seeing a shift in things. Who knows? I don't know. But here's to hoping for better things for the future. Another little tidbit is Dummy Xi is a member of Canada's sizable Chinese descended population, and the film is focused on them, just like her short Bao. Much like Enrico Casarosa based Luca on his childhood in Italy, Dummy Xi plays Turning Red on her own childhood, based Turning Red on her own childhood growing up in Canada, and Ming being based on her own mother. Mm-hmm. So that's actually really cool, because now you're going to be able to see some of those similarities with how the mom is played by Sandra Oh in comparison to her mom in real life. I wonder if that's like the conversation they had like at the dinner table later after, like, "So honey, I saw your movie the other day." It's like, oh shoot, like I would feel like that would be the conversation.
Well, I know that she addressed it, Dummy Xi addressed it, because at the end of this movie, what the movie means, she reestablishes and kind of uses too in Bao. She was saying that her mom came in, and on the featurette for Bao, her mom had come into the kitchens at the studio and had shown everybody and all the animators how she makes Bao. And so they were standing there watching her, and they used some of her hand movements and other things to connect her mom to that story. And then, and I'd seen it today, but she was saying that the resolution, and I'm not going to spoil it right now so we can talk about it a little bit, the resolution of this film helped ensure that her and her mom could have a better relationship, even if it wasn't the one they originally started with.
And I think it's really cool that we're getting the opportunity to see a lot more personal stories with a lot of our mm-hmm. filmmakers, like we had just mentioned with obviously Dummy Xi, and also like Enrico Casarosa
for Luca, yeah.
And I don't really know the full length of where the story for Coco came about, but I feel like that one also too holds a special place for certain people. I mean, when we're starting to get opportunities where people can actually show their roots in the story that they're creating, it really does change the way we as consumers view it. And it creates that connection, because it's like, especially for young kids who are like, oh, you know, I want to be an animator when I grow up, I want to be a director. And you have people like these directors who are showing their roots, their past, their traditions in the movies that they're making. It kind of opens up those walls for those kids who are wanting to do things like that, but aren't sure if their heritage or their ethnicity are going to be able to.
There's space for them in the the culture, in the field itself. Like, yeah, that's something that's always been kind of concerning for anybody who follows anything that they're truly passionate about, if there's space for them.
Yeah. One last piece of information. What? You give me dirty looks.
No, I'm not.
Say it.
I'm not.
Say it.
No.
Mudday. Just yeah, blood sport thing. Huh?
Yeah.
You should get it now.
I saw blood sport.
You should get it.
Yes, that's why I got it.
One last little piece of information. The film's technical supervisor, Susan Fong, is actually type 1 diabetic. So in accordance with Disney's initiative for real-life representation, there are actually two characters in the film wearing diabetes technology in the form of a continuous glucose monitor, or a glucosamer.
Yeah.
Which allows diabetics to monitor their glucose levels in real time instead of taking random samples at certain times.
I really now want to go find the people in the background that are wearing them.
So if you're unfamiliar with these types of meters, they're essentially, they look like tags, little round circle tags. The only reason I know is because my mom has one.
Yeah.
They go on your arm or wherever you usually take measurements, and they look like stickers, but they're actually, they got tiny needles in them, and they're like little, almost like the RFID tags that they have at like, stores when they're trying not to let people
security
steal.
Tags.
Yeah. And so all you do is you usually turn it on, or you swipe it with the meter or with the app on your phone, and it actually sends in real time the blood sugar levels immediately to your phone or to your device. So seeing as there's two people in there, it's gonna be really interesting to like go back, and it's like the Where's freaking diabetic Waldo in the movie, because it's really small. Mm-hmm. But it's cool that they've actually included it, and it adds again to that representation conversation. Yeah. We were talking about earlier, in the fact that there are people who are being represented, even in the smallest of ways. Like, in an animated film, someone like my mom, if my mom cared to find herself in movies like this, or anyone else, it, or even children who are dealing with it at a young age, if they're looking at it and they're like, oh, you know, I see somebody who has the same thing I have. You know, oh, that's cool. I'm, you know, that person is like me. It creates another bridge of connection for those types of people. Mm-hmm. And it's just another sense of awesomeness that they're doing within this film, and what they've been doing in terms of just making those opportunities. That's not to say that they're out of the woods yet with everything in Florida, I'm just saying.
Very true.
But, you know, it's still cool to see those steps and strides being made by the filmmakers that are in this movie. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I feel like it's also a great opportunity where people who are a part of these types of movies are wanting that. Like, yeah. They're making the effort. I mean, because I'm pretty sure it could have been easy to say, like, ah, don't worry about it. I mean, it's not a big deal. Or, you know, oh, it's not even important. It's cool. But sadly, there's such a lack of it within the framework of our cinematic universe right now, with everything in theaters and past and present, that to actually put it in means more than most people think. And I say it's sad because every person deserves an opportunity to be represented on screen. Mm-hmm. That should have been the case since day one.
Sure.
If you're making every effort to either make a mockery or make like a satire of anything, or even, you know, if you want certain things represented, instead of, you know, playing it as playing it safe and just making everybody white or making everybody, you know, one note or whatever, having the opportunity to create this actually allows people to be seen and to be heard and to know that there is a possibility for people like them to be a part of things like this and be represented. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, it's one of those things where it's like, because I know, when was it? I think when we were talking about Scream. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Scream, the 2022 one. And we had junior filmosopher Sarah here.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, you know, representation and having it done properly, as opposed to, you know, just slapping a label on it and then making a scene that's supposed to assume that, oh, this person is this, by the way. Mm-hmm. Like, to check a box. Like, let's not make it like that. Let's make it a part of this story, you know, and not just a box to check off. Like, oh, we did this, boom, you know.
And I appreciated it for me being able to see in the background that there was the community that was in the background of Toronto was a community. There were people in hijabs. There was, I believe, the security guard. He might have been Sikh. He was wearing a turban.
Yeah.
And there were more. I was more excited. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. This isn't the, no offense to The Incredibles, the background in The Incredibles where it's everybody's either a brunette, a blonde, and they're primarily white. There were so many people, and it was so nice to just be able to see a community, like, within this movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the nice thing about Pixar's new, like, focus on, like, you know, diversity, is that it gives, like, an actual real-world texture to every, like... Yeah. Scene where, like, they're just background people, but, like, they, you know, they don't just, like, exist for this. They, like, have their own lives and are going somewhere, which I feel like is super cool.
I agree.
Absolutely. So, jumping into this review, this is going to be
a spoiler.
We are going to spill some spoilers. This is a spoiler-filled review. This movie's been out. We just really want to dive into it because there's so much to get into in this movie. And we don't want to leave anything out for fear of wanting to revisit this later on and have another type of episode. So first thing I want to ask, because this movie takes place in 2002. Mm-hmm. And it's very apparent.
Aggressively.
So aggressive.
I wanted to check in with you guys. I wanted to see, where were you guys at around the early 2000s? Like, what were some of the things you guys were into in terms of, like, early 2000s pop culture? Because that is essentially, this child is us. Yeah. This, like, I mean, to, like, an extent,
like, her opening statement of, like, you know, I do what I want and say what I want 24/7. I was like, Like, I've talked to this girl before, ages ago.
I know her.
It's the one girl we avoid at school.
And then, like, I didn't think about it till later. Like, after I was watching the movies, I was like, she's my age. Because she would be, like, in her, like, early to, like, mid-30s now.
She should be, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, ah.
She's a millennial.
Yeah, I'm like, this is why this movie probably speaks to me so loudly.
I mean, Spencer is a young Asian female. I mean, just for it. Yes. So, where were you guys?
I was in high school enjoying anime and learning about computers.
Okay.
2002.
Hold on. What kind of music were you into? Because music plays a big role in this movie.
Massive.
That's very true. This is probably getting close, depending on when it released, to my disappointment of that Jurassic Park 3 soundtrack. Oh, what year did that come out? 2001. So yeah, right around then. So like, actually, like a lot of like what I listened to back then was soundtracks, and you know, hearing like pop music on like the bus ride to school.
Mm. Were you a pop music fan?
No, I was not.
It's like no. What about you, Ames?
Dum dum dum.
Oh boy.
So yes, I was a very gentle part of the boy band phase.
I thought you said gentle part of the void. I'm like
I'm going gracefully into the night. Boy bands hit probably around 96, 97, and then they consistently were around in the mainstream until, for the most part, until 2003 or so. If you get to 2005, they're still there, but not as much. So I was actually, in 2002, I was 16. Later end of, I would have been 15, 16. So I was a sophomore. I listened to pop, but not a lot of boy bands. I had transitioned out of that at the latter half of my middle school. And the funny thing is, I understood exactly what she was talking about, because eighth grade for me was boy band territory at 13. And I remember all of that. And it was really scary.
Were you boy band crazy?
I wasn't boy band enough crazy, but I was enough that I knew, like, there were notes that hit perfectly in here where I was like, I remember that. I remember something like that. And then I had friends who were head to toe merch, the burned or stolen copies of CDs, concert tours, like the whole jam. I had people that were that aggressively crazy, including I had two friends who never talked to each other ever again, because one was a Backstreet Boys fan and one was an NSYNC fan.
Is that the reason why they never talked to each other again?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was really petty.
So, here's the thing.
There's a thing.
Yeah.
You didn't like boy bands?
No, I didn't. I wasn't a big boy band fan. I grew up a rocker. I was raised on oldies, and in my junior high and high school, I feel like I was born too late because I fell in love with grunge music. You know, I was into Soundgarden, Nirvana, I was into Bush, I was into, you know, all those types of bands, and I would play them on repeat on CDs and just, like, hang out in my room.
That's early 90s. You're in the wrong place.
I went to NASA. I went to NASA in 2000 and... No, I think it was 2000. In 2000, I went to NASA for a program. And the entire time, I had the first debut album of Bush on repeat. I listened to that song, Glycerin, about 500 times. Throughout my entire time there. I did know people who were like super fans, including people in my family, who would like have all the burned CDs. They would bring out their big book of their collection of CDs. Just
I still have that, but not with like swiped boy band albums.
No, it was like they were either multiple copies of the same CD just in case. It was like the original, and then they would listen to the burn copy.
Just in case, because
just
someone
so you didn't
scratched,
get scratches on the first one.
Or someone stole it.
And then they had recordings of the band at concerts from like Japan and London,
where they had the very special releases. And
I don't know. Okay,
no, I'm letting you know what's on those albums.
I'm like, I don't know.
They literally bring it up in the movie when she gets the burn CD.
Yeah. Like that's what they had, and they had all these different songs, and they were always singing all these songs, and I'm like, why would you listen to that? That's it. It seemed like overly sweetened music. I don't know. I was just so used to being in my feels when it came to music. Not that I'm saying that the boy bands can't get into their feels or whatever. That's not what I'm saying. I don't know. I didn't really give it a listen to. But here's the other thing, and I don't think I've mentioned it to either of you in maybe the history of our friendship. My school that I was at was extremely so I went to a Christian private academy. Part of the stipulation of me going there was I, as a child, as well as my parents, had to sign a long document agreeing that I wouldn't do any of these things considered ungodly.
Did you gyrate?
My school didn't allow us to go to concerts like that.
What?
Now, I say don't allow because it got pretty crazy, because at one time, NSYNC came to town, and four people went to the concert. The administration found out. They all got suspended.
Seriously?
One person, who was a senior, I believe, at the time, a guy, was so upset. His mom, because his parents were divorced, and dad was the one who paid for him to go there. His mom was the one who bought him tickets. His mom took it to the news and to the local whatever media. There were gobs of journalists at my school for about 3 weeks straight because they were fighting this in court because they were suspending her son for going to or it might have been Backstreet Boys. It was one of the big two. And so it turned into this huge thing where like we had this huge assembly and they're like, you're not allowed to talk to the press. You're not allowed to say anything. They're not allowed to come up to you unless your parents are there. You cannot speak on behalf of the school. Teachers, please be aware. Do not allow any of your kids, blah, 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 blah. We literally had this conversation with the entire school. And then they reiterated it every day at the end of the school day because there were so many. It was like Scream, but for this. Because there were all these, you know, these news reporters like in vans and in cars, and there were camera folk, and they were like waiting for somebody to come out. And like you could, I heard stories of one of the kids like got paid by one of the reporters to go off to the other side where there wasn't any administration to give them a quick little interview of what was going on inside. And they blurred her face, and apparently the kid got like $60 out of it.
You could have gone for 80. I mean, yeah, for the time though, shoot. I'd be like, yeah, what?
I'd be very happy to eat it. It was $60.
I'd be like, $60, and you're not going to show my face, and you're going to make me sound different.
The school literally got upset and did this huge gathering where they told everybody that we had a God given responsibility to turn in whoever that
was. Whatever. Oh my gosh. If I was a parent at this school, I would be down there yelling at people.
We have a God given right to turn in people who enjoy music that is not our music.
So I don't know if I ever told you guys that story.
No,
but Footloose. I'm still friends with this guy on Facebook, and I say hi every now and then.
You said hi and asked him about turning red?
No.
You should have.
but it's crazy. Like, it turned... And you want to hear something even crazier? All the people minus that guy that went to this concert were all related in some form or fashion to the pastor's wife and the pastor, but I say the pastor's wife because she was the administrator for the entire school. So
no,
it was interesting. It was interesting. That's all I'm saying. But like, I say all that to say there was a lot of like negativity on that particular. Oh, we were talking about it earlier. The Christian boy band group Plus One.
Yes, we were. Oh Lord!
But
literally, they, oh Lord!
they actually sent me to that concert, so that wasn't. Either way, there was a lot of negativity around boy bands.
The school sent you to that concert?
Yeah.
Well, wait, how's that any different?
Because it's a Christian band.
Oh, whatever. Get off your high horse.
It wasn't just a high horse. It was a couple of horses stacked up on each other.
I don't like this.
Which is great because I went to a private school and I remember I learned and got cassettes for Alanis Morissette and a lot of oldies. So I learned a lot of oldies and then. But I remember like... Alanis Morissette was like, shh, we don't talk about it. And then apparently there was a boycott at my private school about DC Talk because of Dobie Mac rapping.
So let me tell you, no, hold on,
this
hold on.
This is devolving. We are not talking about Turning Red and representation.
No, we're talking about our kid, our childhood.
Our kiditude.
Our childhood at this time. Okay, this is how bad, this is how bad this school got. There was a quote unquote revival at my school.
Ooh-hoo.
We were told
you had a tent
to bring in. No, but we did have a burning pit.
Oh.
They asked us to bring in all of our bad CDs, our bad stuff, all of our bad books, our bad magazines, and we were told to place them into this giant fire pit that we make chicken on, mind you. There were Britney Spears CDs in there. There were NSYNC albums. There were some...
Were there Archie comic books? Because that's the gateway to all hell.
I don't know. But, so, you may have had it bad, but I had it worse. No offense.
No, you
was
do.
Was this, like, a whole, like,
my Christian school is still around.
This is just... This was my life.
This
we were talking about boy bands.
So,
and he said,
talking
like,
about...
Suddenly.
So, going back to Turning Red. So, obviously, each of us have a different perspective on that early 2000s pop culture era.
Yeah.
Late 90s, early 2000s. So let's talk about back to Turning Red.
Thank you.
What were some of your guys' first impressions after seeing the film? I want to start with Amy because I figure she's going to be the most animated.
All the puns and the jokes. It helps that I'm a woman. So this movie, first impression or
first impressions
after it, immediately after it.
Yes.
This I wanted to see it again because there were so many things I felt like I got it. But I didn't get it. Also, I wasn't wearing my glasses, so there were sequences I wanted to see. It happened. I couldn't find my glasses again, Spence. You know how I am. And I got new pairs, and I had put away my safety glasses. I couldn't find my safety glasses. So I watched it, and I'm like, oh, I get this. And I remember being aspects of Maylin. I had aspects of Maylin that I remember me being and my friends being. And then the same thing with her as her mom.
Maylee,
sorry. Because Ming's her mom, yes? So, yes. Maylee. She's Maylee Lin.
Yes.
I thought it was Maylin Lee.
Yeah. It should be that one.
It's Maylin Lee.
That's what I have here.
You might want to check it. May.
Maylin.
Yeah. Maylin Lee. So, I remember connecting with things that she had done, things that she had experienced, some of those moments, and then also simultaneously... her mother were things that I understand as a mother, also connecting with a relationship with my mother, and the Ranma poofs were sending me into absolute tizzies, but I wanted to see it again. My first impression, I need to see this again. There are things that I miss, and I want to see it again. Spencer!
First impressions after seeing this movie, honestly, mostly because it came at the end of the movie. The song we played earlier, like, there's a chant sequence earlier in the movie. I was like, well, this chant is definitely coming back later on. And it did with the boy band. And I was like, and I kind of got fixated on just that. Because it was all.
Spencer's like, where was that in my childhood?
No, like, it was just like done so musically well that these things fit together in a piece. That, like, I just was, like, I was kind of listening to that in a loop. Just, like, really trying to like feel that out. I was like, it feels like it shouldn't work as well as it does.
It works. But it does. Yeah,
like that's really like the thing. Like that's my first impression after seeing this movie. Like that whole sequence was so good.
Yeah. Yes, Eddie.
Very true. Honestly, my first impression, I had read a lot of reviews prior to just basic headlines, nothing too deep. And I was looking at a lot of them, and then Sarah had sent me a link to an article about somebody who completely bashed it for all the wrong reasons, and it kind of changed my perspective in terms of like how I was seeing the film, because it's like, I don't want to be seen as obtuse, and I don't like before seeing the film. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be seen as obtuse and not try to see. And watching somebody who completely just didn't even try and get obliterated by social media and the internet, I'm like, that's what you get. my first impression after seeing the movie was, I really love this new phase of Pixar. Yeah. Like, I really love this new era of Pixar because now they are making targeted movies. True. Not just movies for all ages. This movie, yes, it's for all ages, but it's not targeting like those young kids in this one. Mm-hmm. Like, no young child is going to find enjoyment or laughter in that scene where the mom's like, I brought aspirin, I brought a hot water bottle, and I brought pads. And
yeah, it's like, I have a kid that did, but I also have a girl. And she's, mind you, she's not.
You have
five.
A girl?
I have two girls, my two children. But my youngest, she's not 5 or 6. And she's seen this movie 2 or 3 times now at this point. And she gets the intent of that sequence where the mom thinks that her period has started and she brings her all the equipment. And she's like, we're going to help you. It's going to be okay, baby. I got you. And I'm like, I remember that. And she thinks it's hilarious because all she's thinking of is that it's the mom being overprotective. She's trying to fix something that it's a misunderstanding. Yeah. So there's no like, yes, I will have to have a talk about your body and all that jam. But it's going over her head in such a great way that she still thinks it's funny. She still gets it. But she's not like, oh, this.
Yeah, because even the scene where she's like, it's just, I'm just red all over. I'm like,
I'm a big,
oh,
stinky red God. Monster.
And I'm like, oh, my God. It's like, are they going to go that? They're going to go. They went that far. Okay, cool.
Well,
like, I absolutely adore the fact that this movie is not for, it's not targeting that younger crowd anymore. Mm-hmm. This movie is definitely a young teen movie.
Yeah.
This is a movie not only for, it's dual wielding. It's got two sides to it. It's targeting the young teens who are coming of age and who are in that place, and it's targeting everybody who was a young teen, mm-hmm, in that era of the early 2000s and connect with that immediately, that are like the boy band crazy ones, the ones who know people who were boy band crazy back in the day, who were coming of age, recognizing like the need for friends, the impact friends have in your life at that age, where most parents at the time were like, oh, they're just friends. Friends will come and go, whatever. But then you remember when you were that age, your friends were everything. They were the glue that kind of held you together at times, because sometimes parents didn't always understand. And it's great. I was like, I may not be a young teenage, you know,
lady.
Young teenage Asian woman, but I know people, or I've experienced some of those elements as a teen when I was that age, that super resonated. So I think that was the biggest first impression for me when it came to this particular film, because, I mean, we take a look at the actors in this film and we look at all the great voices that we have. People like Rosalie Chiang, who played Mei Lin.
Well, and she wasn't even supposed to be the final voice.
No, she was just a stand-in.
She was the fill-in.
Yeah. She was actually supposed to be just the stand-in, the person who's going to read lines so that everybody else can do their lines and deliver, like Sandra Oh and all these other great actresses and actors that are in the film. And they liked her so much. So like, yeah, I think we found her voice, and just kept her in there. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool for Rosalie Chiang, because I wonder if that's her first.
Well, and I thought was she a storyboard artist as well?
I believe she is a storyboard
because that
artist.
Was so oh, usually wow. What they would do whenever they do the storyboard, you're doing storyboards and you're coming in for your pitch. If you're the artist, you're in there and you're talking about the scene. You do all the voices, you do the sounds, like you're the storyteller. And for her to be able to come through and do something that not only did she sound genuine, but she embodied everything in those moments that it made it so relatable. I just like, yes, I love you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
She's absolutely great. But I mean, even for the role of the mom by Sandra Oh, Sandra Oh has just been a phenomenal voice in the movement for representation for Asian actors and actresses. And seeing her come in and just be incredible as the mom.
It was unexpected. For me, it was unexpected because the first time... So I've never watched Grey's Anatomy. And Sandra Oh, I know, hysterically enough, as the principal from the very first Princess Diaries movie. And she was Principal Gupta. And I remember seeing her and her physicality and the way she presented. She was so wonderful and so lovely. I'm like, I like you.
Yeah.
I'm going to like you.
Well, and she's got a massive,
filmography.
From everything from ER to... Oh, I'm sorry, not ER. Grey's Anatomy. She was in 6 Feet Under. Judging Amy. She was in The Proud Family. She's done a lot of different things for the film industry, as well as played a lot of, you know, film-centered roles. She was in the second Mulan movie. Mm-hmm. There's just so many different aspects of her repertoire. Even she was in She-Ra and the Princess of Power.
Yep.
That series. So
the newer one or the old one?
The new one.
Okay.
Princesses of Power is new one.
Yeah. Okay. New one. Yeah.
I guess it didn't have a subtitle for the original.
Okay. Yep.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, somebody like her in this role, she not only played this role as a mom well, but I feel like drawing on even from her personal experiences, she played a great Asian mom in this aspect as well. And the fact that you're getting this character portrayed by an authentic Asian woman who knows what most moms are like and can draw from those experiences really does tell the difference. It kind of goes back to when they did Finding Nemo and they wanted to find the voice of Bruce. And so instead of actually having somebody come in and imitate an Australian accent, they actually brought an actual Australian actor to formulate the voice. And it does a world of difference because I don't know if you guys have ever seen the making of Finding Nemo, but they have the actual two voice castings side by side, and they play the American one and then they play the Australian one. And it's like the Australian one is so much better. And it just feels more authentic. There's just more to it. And so drawing from those experiences, it makes it work a lot better.
What I could say real quick about moms is also that the grandmother is Michelle Yao.
No.
You told me grandmother was Michelle.
No. I thought because she sounds like it, but it's Wai Ching Ho. She's also the woman who plays Madame Gao in Daredevil.
No.
Yeah.
Madame Gao showing up.
So
she's so good, though.
Yeah. She is really good. She's also from your... Oh, no. Not that one. I was going to say, she's in the Awkwafina is Noir from Queens series.
Didn't watch that one.
She's also from... I mean, she's been in Defenders and Daredevil. But the fact is that she's got such a wonderful, unique voice.
Yes.
That it creates this presence when she's on screen. The grandmother is by far one of the most powerful presences in this film because of everything that she carries as the matriarch of this family. Mm-hmm. So I loved her. She was great. Was there anybody that stood out to you, Spence?
I'm going to say May's entire friend group.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because like each one of them is ridiculous in their own right, but they just gel so well together that they were like just a delight to watch them hang out. Like there's like a sequence where like they're trying to make money and like they make like their own little music video together.
Yeah.
And like just seeing them like hang out together was like fun and adorable.
Yeah. They were really great. And they the cool thing is that like the girl who played the voice of Priya, she's Maitreyi Ramakrishnan. She's actually Middle Eastern. So it works out really well to have somebody who's pulling from, like we said, you know, those... She identifies as... Oh, well, she is Middle Eastern, but she's from Canada, so also biting into that. The one who did the voice of Miriam was great as well. Abby, played by Hyun Park, was wonderful.
I'm fairly and the one thing I wanted to bring up for High End Park. So when I had mentioned I thought she was speaking Korean, you thought she was speaking Japanese, and when we first meet her in the hallway when it's like besties assemble, mm-hmm. great moment. She is Korean, but she's also an artist for Pixar that they ended up using for her voice, and I'm like yes, keep going, take from your house, let us support people.
Amy, was there anybody else that you wanted to highlight? I don't know if you got a chance to highlight anybody. Lisa,
Abby was great. The father.
Yeah, that's awesome. He is
so low-key brilliant. And he's low-key brilliant. He does exactly what in those strong alpha-led households. You're thinking, oh, he's a pushover. He's this, he's that. He doesn't. He comes in at just the right moment to give the wisdom and the support. It's that quiet confidence that you never think some of these parents have. And he's just like, let me slip you the reason why this is going the way this is. And you're like, oh.
Yeah.
And then if I was going to bring up one more, I cannot not bring up the incomparable James Hong.
Anytime he's in anything.
The fact that he is... he's a little old man,
Mr. Gao,
and he's a shaman, and he's like, I've been doing this for years, and I'm just like, I love you so much.
And for Mr. Gao, we see him at the beginning of the film, like multiple times. He's either playing Pai Gao.
I thought he was playing Go. Was he playing Pai Gao?
It might have been Go, either or checkers. I don't remember. They're playing a game. And she moves a piece for him, but you see him in the beginning, and then you see him like when Mei Lin does that whole jump over as the red panda over him, kind of like a Free Willy.
Yes.
And he looks up, and it's like, oh, you see that. But I mean, James Hong is just such a magnificent treasure in Hollywood. Yes. I'm not even going to go to the aspect of his abilities with pushing further the opportunities for Asian representation. I'm just talking about as a voice actor, an actor in the industry, this man does not know when to quit. He is such a great actor. He is such a great voice actor. Everything that everybody has known him from, you can look at everybody's like youngest time period when they were kids to when they were younger to where they are now, and everybody has quite possibly a favorite James Hong movie.
Yeah.
Whether if it's like Kung Fu Panda, whether if it's Big Trouble in Little China, whether if it's that episode on Seinfeld.
when he's in Mulan.
When he's in Mulan.
Oh my gosh, he's been in so much stuff for Disney too, just across the board. In Avatar.
Yep.
He's...
You're talking about the series.
Yes, the series. Okay, we're not talking about the movie.
Just making sure.
He steered clear of it. He is a treasure in and of himself, and I am so delighted to continue to hear him and be able to point him out when I hear him. Like, it's just, it's so good.
Yeah. Talking about this particular story, this is a very unique tale because I don't think we've seen a coming of age tale within Pixar or Disney that quite puts it in this light where you essentially, I mean, there have been other films, but more so on the line of like live action, and some in the sense of horror, to be quite frank, that I know of personally. Things like Ginger Snaps. Ginger Snaps is a movie about coming of age. You got movies like, what's that movie? What is that werewolf movie with Michael J. Fox?
Teen Wolf.
I was
like, ooh, that end sequence, though. We don't talk about that last scene.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
Teen Wolf. Movies where like actual physical transformations are part of like this parallel to actual changes in the person's human body to becoming, you know, a adult, a grown up kind of thing. Which most of the time, most cinema has been around using that format, like werewolves or creatures of the night or even in a sense vampires, to create that parable, if you will, for, you know, what's it called, puberty. But now Pixar is throwing its hat into the ring and creating that puberty story through animation, and it's really great where we get the opportunity to see it not only in that form of animation but from the sense of a story based in Asian folklore. I don't know. I really do appreciate a lot of what they're doing. I don't know. What do you think, Spence, in regards to Pixar kind of picking up the ball there in making those types of films and making it available to all ages?
I think it's great. It's a summary of that. Like, really just, like, taking, like, the last couple of years, not just this movie, but, like, you know, Coco as well. Like, they've done a good job of just bringing together, like, stories that, while targeting a specific demographic, can also be approachable by anyone. And it, like, kind of opens the doors to how, like, seeing other people and cultures, which I really enjoy and is something they need to really lean into in my book.
Yeah.
Because, like the last couple of years of Pixar movies have been, like, really fantastic.
Yeah.
Of just, like...
And specifically Pixar.
Yeah. Not you, House of Mouse. You're working on it, but you're not there yet. But, like, it's been just a really fun ride. And, like I always looked forward to Pixar movies before they started doing this. But now I especially, like whenever, like, oh, new Pixar movie's coming, I'm like, well, this is going to be fun. Like, even this one, like, girl turns into a red panda. I don't know how to take this, but I'm like, based on what they've done before, I was like, this is probably going to be an awesome ride. And it was.
Yeah. It's crazy how you look at, I'm looking at Pixar's filmography, and, you know, they only have 25 movies from Pixar itself. But, I mean, we have some really great entries that honestly give certain perspectives on the human condition in each and every one of them. I mean, you look at, you know, starting with the first film, bringing somebody who's brand new into a friend group that currently exists that, you know, may take your place within that friend group, you know, moving forward to things like The Incredibles, trying to be trying to be somebody who's taking care of everybody, doing whatever you need without losing yourself within it, realizing that the thing that made you great was the thing you've had all along. I mean, even to movies that have no words for, like, the first 30-40 minutes of it, like in WALL-E, you know, and valuing the things that you have. I mean, all these movies, I mean, even up until the last three movies where friggin' Pixar takes on the element of death and tries to make it into a kid-friendly movie. I don't think I've ever had such an existential crisis after watching a Pixar film then watching Soul and trying to figure out, man, this would be a great opportunity to bring up the mentality or the concept of losing someone to children, but how do I perceive it, and how now through this lens can I help myself process through it when things are going on in my life? And it's crazy because that conversation stemmed out of a dang kids movie, you know? you know, and like with Luca, oh my God, Luca, and now with Turning Red. I mean, we're getting all these great life lessons out of these movies, and now we're in an age where with Turning Red, we're, you know, not to sound cliche, but we're turning the page in Pixar's ability to not only notch up the story element to have portions of it meet people where they are, certain types of people where they are, but now we're making whole movies that are meeting people where they are. You know, and I feel like that just speaks volumes of what they're doing. I mean, what do you think, Amy?
Well, when it comes to this is the first time that, to be very honest, and why I think there's such controversy, is that we've established a lot through film male puberty, or we blanket it as kid puberty. And when it comes down to it, the biggest controversy that's coming forward is that people are uncomfortable talking about female puberty. It is, I find that this isn't just a double-edged sword. It's almost like a triple or quadruple-edged sword, because whatever lens you decide to focus on is how you're going to see that movie. If you look at Turning Red as a coming-of-age story, where it is her mother thinks the red peony has bloomed, and she's having her first...
That's what she calls it. Yeah.
And the best part about that sequence, too, is when her mom's freaking out, the husband's nowhere to be seen. I was just like, get it. I know what you're doing. And it's uncomfortable. Or if you're looking at it as the fact of it's her emotional growth and her steps into womanhood, or her accepting her body and being proud of who she is. There's so many facets about being a woman and that transition that is completely snubbed, or it's like, ew, we don't want to talk about that. Leave your gross stuff alone. And most of the time, the complaints have come from people who are like, I don't want to have to explain to my children or my daughter how her body works. And I don't want to have to explain to another boy, this is what happens when girls go through puberty and become, are capable of having babies. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you are a woman, but it means you're capable of having children. The other thing that I really appreciated about this was that it focuses in two spaces about how her hormones respond to her. Devin in the Daisy Mart. All the friends are goo-goo-eyed about the boys. And she's like, he's so gross. And then she just has her moment of awakening. And she's freaked out about it herself. And in her mother's, her mother finding out makes it even worse. And it's just that transition. And it's handled with such care and such understanding. It's, I've been there. This is what happened to me. And this is where we're proceeding forward. It doesn't get brought up ever again after they have the car ride home about how her hormones are raging and now she's staring at boys and Devin from the, you know, the Daisy Mart, like aside from the Ahuga, which was great, which was a callback to Looney Tunes. Mel Blanc, right?
I don't think it was Looney Tunes per se, but it is an early cartoon.
But so, like, it's accepting and understanding and still having playful honesty about a situation that every girl goes through in that transition. And I loved being able to see it and have my oldest daughter go, yeah, I feel like that sometimes. Or, oh, I remember when suddenly I liked boys. Like, or I remembered when I suddenly liked people, or this happened. And it's able to connect it, and you feel grounded in the story. With Luca, they had some controversy as well, because people were looking at it from the two different lenses. Some believed that it was a coming out story. Some believed that it was a puberty story. Some believed that it was a your best friends are together story. It's growing and changing and moving apart. We're seeing Pixar taking on topics that are uncomfortable to the general public because they don't want, because it's behind closed doors. We don't talk about it. We don't.
Well, and even in certain cultures as well, it's not a very, like, take, you know, like the Asian culture, it's the whole idea of it and it getting out, like, public knowledge and having, sometimes it's a sense of shame. So having it as a conversation within this Asian family and having it on the silver screen also speaks to that ability of having conversations outside of just the home or being ashamed about it in that sense.
Well, and it's the shame of the women. It's never the men in this family. The thing that they bring up in the temple that May points out on her first tour is we celebrate our ancestors and not just the boy ancestors either. Like, and that's the way she says it too. Sorry.
She does. That's the way she says it.
Sorry. The way she says it is she's like, be proud of them. Be proud of the women, not just the men. And then when it comes to light that for so long, the women, as much as they're like, we celebrate the women in our house, all of these women have been hiding this secret.
Yeah.
And they keep hiding it. And the expectation is that the generation, for every generation, we hit ours, you're going to hide yours too.
Yeah.
You do not get the opportunity to stand out and be proud of who you are. And
we go to X lengths to make sure that it never comes up again.
And the thing is that that is part of you growing as a human regardless. That is the universal constant. Every facet and every side of you is valid. And it is a part of who you are. And it will continue to form and mold. And it may change. You may decide one day you wake up and you don't like mermen and bucket hats. That's okay. Mm. Thank God. I had a bucket hat. Never did the merman face. But that is part of growing up. It's part of moving forward and becoming a better human is accepting who you are. And the way May's family, somewhat almost begrudgingly, but understanding, the women say, yeah, we accept you for who you are. And the dad coming out the gate was like, yes, I accept you for who you are. And I love this. And I think this is funny. Go forward with that. When it comes down to it, can you guys think of at any other time in film or in TV where female puberty or female growth, whatever you want to call it,
specifically female
has been shown in a positive light that doesn't include horror?
Oh, I'm out of that one.
Yeah, the only one I can think of is Pepper Ann.
I love Pepper Ann.
The Disney show from the 90s.
I love Pepper Ann.
It's a great show. But that was the one where, like, you know, I remember there was, like, an episode where she needed to start wearing a bra, and it was, like,
I forgot about that one.
Yeah, it was her going through, like, the horror of, like, going with her mom to places, and her mom's like, my daughter needs a bra! And so she screams it into, like, a microphone, and everyone across the mall hears it.
I love it.
Honestly, the only one that really comes to mind, sadly for me, well, there's a few. But
that aren't horror movies.
You're making this difficult.
I am because I'm.
But I mean, like, okay, from my history with film, like, there's a movie called Y Tu Mama También.
Okay,
that's a coming of age story, but it's for boys.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Lady Bird is technically a female coming of age movie, but the one that also comes to mind that I'm surprised you didn't mention anything, Amy, was Welcome to the Dollhouse, which is a horrible movie.
It's so it's an indie film. I watched it when I was, oh my gosh, in my early teens.
I can genuinely say this, Spencer. She should not have seen this movie at that age. Not a movie for a kid. But yeah, that movie's so bad.
But and that the other thing is that it's not fully in a positive light. It is it's exploring her moving to womanhood, her puberty, but it is not like super positive because there is so much cringe to it. It is not fully taken as a healthy exploration of her puberty.
Yeah.
Versus like Carrie, where Carrie is like the reason I have a feeling everybody's afraid of being honest about their bodies.
Well, and then a couple other ones, like you have what's that movie? Like Dirty Dancing is another one. She's coming of age. She's only 16 in the movie, or 15.
But it's also like you don't focus fully on her and her growth. It's kind of like, well, we're focused on everything that's happening.
Here
at the
is
resort.
One. Patrick Swayze. Here is one that I actually went to the theaters, I believe, to go see, or I rented a Blockbuster as soon as it came out on video. A movie called Now and Then, back in the 90s.
Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, but for older time.
So.
Which that was a book series and a movie series that technically kind of rotated into that, America Ferrera with the new
But, one. I mean, if we're talking horror movies, I mean, we could go on.
Yeah, that seems kind of sad to me.
Well, I mean, because the thing is that, I mean, before movies like this, you looked at movies, or you looked at the change in people, and it was scary for some people because we didn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't make it something where we could go to other people or we could go to other adults. It was strictly within the confines of your home, your family, your teacher was your mom. Or same thing as a boy, your body, your changes, your teacher was your dad, kind of thing. Very rarely did you have an opportunity to have like a sex ed, you know, type of thing at school. Or whatever, like, in that sense, like we were saying, Carrie, The Witch is one of those ones, The Lost Boys, it is a big movie about coming of age, both the original with Tim Curry and the remake. That first movie is all about coming of age, whether or not if you see it or not, Amy, but no, have you seen the first one?
What, The Lost Boys?
No, it.
Part of it.
Yeah.
Like Tim Curry's, yes.
No.
Part of Tim Curry's.
You it. Haven't seen the new one, It?
No.
Oh, you should.
No. Bill Skarsgård already scars me as it is, as a human. Oh,
but there's a lot of those types of movies. I mean, even to a certain sense, like Pan's Labyrinth,
oh, yeah.
To a certain element, it is still a little bit scary, but it is a coming-of-age story as a young girl who has to become a woman in the faces of the like Spanish Civil War. Great movie. There's a lot of them, but you're right, Spence, they were on the basis of being horror because we didn't talk about it. And because we didn't talk about it, filmmakers could make that effort to say, oh, you know, well, since we don't talk about it, this is this person's interpretation, or this is this person's interpretation, or this is how they saw it, and blah, blah, blah. And therefore we get this kind of a skewed view of our own changes through the lens of this horrific, you know, depiction. But that kind of brings me to kind of bringing things back around to positive.
It was a negative. It was so positive.
Well, no, I mean, though, the negativity of it being portrayed as a scary thing. Like, so, now
I get that better.
Now we have, like, and I use Pixar because Pixar is pretty much the foremost company who is bringing these kinds of conversations to a childlike conversation state where we can have these conversations with kids and they can have a better understanding without having to scar them. True. I mean, like I said, my biggest kudos to still to Pixar for everything they've done is Soul. That is one of the hardest conversations to have with a kid, to let them know, like, oh, Uncle so-and-so is not with us anymore. They passed away. How do you explain that to a child without them losing it or not understanding or having to give them too many details? Soul created that conversation and made it an opportunity to where this conversation can now be had with the viewing of a movie and an added conversation at the tail end of it. And it just opens the door, and I'm super excited because it actually brings me into my roundtable question. We've seen everything that Pixar has done. We've seen what some movies have done previous, but I'm mainly talking about Pixar because they're really on that positive end of it. What is the next human situation moment that you would like to see portrayed in a Pixar film?
What do you mean?
So, like, we've discussed, like, mental health with Inside Out. We've discussed almost a sense of discrimination with Luca. We've discussed death. Like, is there something that's a part of the human element that we face every day that you would like to see something portrayed in a Pixar film?
This is a hard one.
Yeah.
And it's just a genuinely hard one because you can't... So the Spark Shorts, which are brought by Pixar, give space for people to explore on a smaller scale topics that might not fit to a big screen. The one that I always think that first comes to mind, there's two of them. There's Out, which was someone's coming out story, which was done beautifully. And also...
That's amazing. I really like that.
Yeah. And then the autism. There was one for autism. Oh, that was...
It was the canoe trip. Or
yeah,
the,
it was... It was, and I don't remember, but... Like, I don't remember the title of it, but it's interacting with somebody that had autism and understanding and how they work differently. And it's something that would not have been as easily translated to the big screen to focus on because it's so heartbreaking and beautiful simultaneously.
Yeah.
And so Pixar right now is exploring concepts and topics in smaller segments and smaller bites to see how people will adapt to it. So I have no idea where Pixar is going.
Well, and mind you, those are shorts. Are shorts. Is there any of those that you would like to see in a full-fledged, full-length film?
Out would be great, to be very honest, because that is something that is not given the full representation or the positivity in film that is it's healthy. It's always secrets. One of the first ones that I thought of was But I'm a Cheerleader, which is from the late 90s, early 2000s, and it's a cheerleader who comes to find out she likes girls. She's trying to figure out how to explore that. Her parents find out. They send her to a conversion house camp. And also there's a young Dante Bosco in it. But either way, it's just, it needs that support.
What about you, Spence? What do you think?
Well, I think I'm going to piggyback on Amy a little bit and say, yeah, probably another coming out story, like a full feature length one. Mm-hmm. Because, like, they've done elements of that in, the shorts you mentioned. And also, like Luca, you can lightly see people who also like oh, this is about this, and you're like, I can kind of get what you're talking about, but not expressly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think probably doing a coming out story where that's a whole movie, that'd probably be something that would probably be right up their alley, especially with how mad they are about Disney and Florida right now.
100%.
It seems right.
take that, Disney. You have to put it out. Put it on your platform. I don't care.
Yeah, I feel like they just give it a cute name and then just be like, oh, it's about this, oops, and then just push it out there. Something else is they could just do what they've been doing with exploring cultures, but just take it from two different places.
Yeah.
Because you've done Coco in Mexico, but you could do something in Spain or something like that.
Yeah.
They're still I don't want this to see one diversity movie per race.
Yeah.
Just do another cycle of let's go somewhere new and learn something about some other people.
Yeah. I feel because I have a couple thoughts. I feel one of the things that I want to see with Pixar going in going forward is we now have the puberty range of storytelling. I want to see another element, kind of like Toy Story 3. I want to see an element where we have somebody who's leaving the nest. Someone who's preparing, who's leaving the realm.
Finding Nemo. Sorry,
no,
keep going.
No. Someone who's leaving the nest in that kind of way, to where he's not only leaving home, but he's also leaving behind every element of the imagination and the childhood wonder that he had to become this person in the adult world, mm-hmm. which is something that everybody has to do. It's not something where they don't lose their childhood, but they only are able to take a part of it with them, you know? And it's something that I feel like it's something all of their animators, I'm pretty sure, have gone through. It's something that all of their, you know, their staff, everybody at one point in time has had that moment where they have to walk over that threshold where they can't be carried to bed anymore. They can't be, you know, they can't go into the stores with their parents and their parents, you know, surprise them with an ice cream cone like they did when they were younger. Or they can't revisit those places. And I wanna, like, it's almost like a running out of time type story, you know, for an age of humanity. For an age of us, where we are. I feel like that would be a great story.
That feels like that story is going to be like the first 10 minutes of Up, but extended yeah. to the whole movie.
Well, I mean,
it's just a lot of us crying.
But yeah, mind you, it
sounds good, though.
No, and mind you, that transition is difficult, but then the latter part of this film, or probably the last part of the film, is recognizing, you know, that as this adult person, you can take all of those influences, all of those things that you had, and make things like this, you know? And it adds to that opportunity to continue that tradition of being childlike and having those memories live on forever in elements like film or books or art, you know, like, you know, actual visual art, in any visual art medium. That's one, mm-hmm. you know, and another one I would like to see. I would like to see a film where the protagonist is, you know, somebody who has, you know, some form of mental difference. You know, I want to see a movie where, you know, the protagonist doesn't always look like this able-bodied child or this child who is, you know, I want to see a film where they actually give that opportunity to show that the hero doesn't always have to look like, you know, you or I as able-bodied people. Mm. You know, I want to see that opportunity kind of going back to Loop. Like, their efforts when they were doing Loop really did change a lot of the way I saw film. And it's like the way they were actually able for that short to get somebody who has autism to do all the lines for the young woman that was in the actual short film. And mind you, it was hard work, but they were able to do it. And I'm like, I want to see that. I want to see somebody who, maybe they have somebody who helps them along the way. Maybe they have somebody who is caring for them, who is, you know, part of that journey, kind of like the Samwise to the Frodo, whatever it may be. I want to see that so that at the end of that movie, I see this child who's probably faced every single battle that I will never face as a young man, as an adult, and see them triumphantly stand at the top of this mountain. You know, I want to see that. And I feel like every child who has these types of differences, to see them be able to see themselves in the hero in that cartoon, I think will definitely make an impact in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
So, but wrapping this whole thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table. I want to start with Amy. Amy, does the film pass or fail? And how many monocles?
Of course this movie passes for me. I loved it, if you can't tell, not just as a mom, but as a woman, and moving forward, I know that I can honestly say that Turning Red, with the voice acting, the message, and the animation, it is consistent, wonderful, beautiful. If you have a problem with it, you need to check it yourself. And yeah, this is you know what? I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5 monocles.
There you go. What about you, Spence?
This movie passes for me.
No.
And I forgot. I wanted to talk about one of my favorite lines from the movie.
Oh, go for it.
Like, I just remembered it. But it's the mom character when, like, May is talking about how she wants to see the Four Town show. And she's like, Why is it called Four Town when there are five members? And I was like, there are too many people in this band. Like, this woman gets it. Like it's just another great writing moment, and I love that line because I was thinking about the first time I saw Four Town as well. So for me, this movie is going to get 5 out of 5. It was really well done. I had a fun time.
There you go. Okay. As far as for me, the film passes. Obviously, this is a movie that definitely has so many things that are just so great to highlight that we just can't fit it all into one episode. I appreciate every aspect of the story writing from the story writers. I appreciate the acting. I appreciate the representation. I appreciate what this story braved to do and create, which is this incredible coming of age story through the lens of Pixar. I absolutely loved it. I feel like we need more movies like this. I feel like this is a great opportunity for Pixar to continue to separate themselves from what was to where they are now and feed into that audience that they have that are actually tracking with these movies. There's 25 movies, which means when the first movie dropped, 25 years later, we're at this point, and these movies are now speaking to these people. Don't do that.
Don't make me math this. Go.
So this is a wonderful film. This is absolutely a phenomenal movie. I'm going to give it a 5 as well. This movie is definitely well deserving of all the accolades and awards and praise it's getting. If you haven't seen it or if you heard negative connotations about it, disregard it. Go see it. Check it out. Steal somebody's login to Apple or Disney Plus. I almost said Apple. Steal somebody's login to Disney Plus. Check it out. Get your if you have a teenager, let them check it out too. Let them resonate with this movie. There's plenty to resonate with. But yeah, this movie, great movie. Awesome work, Pixar. We stand by you 100%.
You're the only animation studio that I can always say, even when they hit their lows, they have never disappointed me in 25 movies.
There you go. So that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Film Losers. Remember, you can check us out at our website at filmlosophers.com. There we got over 300 episodes of all different types, all different shapes and sizes of lessons you can check out. We've got everything from anime to action to romance to whatever, whatnot. If you're looking for it, we probably got it. Check us out, filmlosophers.com. Also check us out on any streaming platform where we have everything. We're on every platform from iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora. Am I missing anything, Spencer?
Nope.
Okay, good. What?
Tune in.
Of course, you can check us out on TuneIn there as well. Also, you can check us out on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. There you can check out all of our excerpts that we're going to be posting for Spencer's Big Score as well as Jane Unseen. She will be on our platform as well as her own platform at
Jane Unseen. The only place that it lives is on Instagram, which really it needs to be put up there. Yeah,
we do. but this is a great movie, and this is a great opportunity. If you haven't had an opportunity to share this kind of conversation with your teenager, or you feel like you just need something that really connects to you in a fun and wonderful way, and you were a teen during those early 2000s, late 90s, this is definitely a movie for you. So I want to thank everybody that was here at the table. And so from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm still intern Amy.
Class dismissed.